listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, live on this beautiful Monday. Tuesday. Oh, that's right, it's Tuesday. It's the first day I'm back on the air. It feels like a Monday. I am lousy with time, as you well know. Half the time, I don't even know what day of the week it is. But and obviously, today is one of those days. But thanks so much to Dr. Mike Newcomb and to Mike Papantonio, the esteemed Mike and Mikes, for filling in for me last week on this mic. Rophone? Yeah, okay. That's a bad joke. By the way, welcome to some new stations. We picked up some new radio stations over the course of the last few weeks, carrying our program live, KPFK in 90.7 in Los Angeles. That's 90.7 FM. KNSJ FM, 89.1 in San Francisco. KBBF FM, 89.1 in San Francisco. KBCS FM, 91.3 in Seattle. They've actually been with us for a little while. And soon to be heard in Portland once again on KXRY FM 91.1. And tonight, also on our TV show tonight, James Hoffa is going to be with us. We're doing a special labor show. I was sitting on a plane a couple of weeks ago, and I'm going to get to Syria in just a second here. I was sitting on a plane a couple of weeks ago, stuck on the tarmac, and it was one of those planes that got the seats in the front of the TVs, you know, the TVs in the front of the seat. And the whole plane was on MSN or on CNBC, the business network. And I couldn't change the dial or anything because they don't let you do that until after the plane takes off, apparently, or what, you know, you got to run your credit card through it or something. I don't know, whatever. But we're all watching CNBC. And there's this whole rapid fire discussion. What if the CEO does that? And what will this do to the stock? And hey, they got a new invention that they're rolling out in this company and that. And I'm thinking, why doesn't somebody do a show like that on labor? You know, why isn't there a fast-paced, interesting, how does it affect me, what a show on labor? So I came back and I sat down with our crew, and Louise and I did, and said, hey, let's do this. And so tonight we're doing it. We're doing a special show. It'll be on Free Speech TV and on RT TV, nationwide, actually internationally. We're in 104 countries in 600 million homes. And James Hoffa, National Labor Reps, Dennis Van Rokel, Fakam Madua, James Ray, labor attorneys, Sarah Jaffe, Stuart Acuff, John Nichols. It's going to be an interesting show. But, of course, the big story of the moment is what the President of the United States had to say over the weekend. And I want to share my thoughts with you on this from a couple of different perspectives. But first, his announcement. Louise and I were home and watching TV live as the president was giving his speech. And he went through all his rationalizations for why we have to send bombs to blow things up in Syria. Which, you know, you've heard me many times quote Abraham Maslow, the famous psychologist back in the 70s, who said, when the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And, of course, all the guys who sit around with the president in the White House to come up with solutions to the world's problems, not all of them, but the vast majority of them, are guys whose hammer is Tomahawk missiles and cruise missiles and bombers and things like that. So we've got a problem in Syria. Well, Syria has a problem. And he's going through his whole rationalization for it. And I was getting more and more concerned. Because I did not hear one word coming from the president about Syria having attacked the United States. Syria threatening to attack the United States. Syria threatening to attack a country with whom we had a binding treaty that required us to help them if they were attacked. I didn't hear any of that. I didn't hear Syria represented. I mean, at least George Bush, you know, lied to us that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction that he was going to set off in New York City or something. And at least Condoleezza Rice went on TV and lied by implying that al-Qaeda was somehow in Iraq, which they weren't. I mean, Saddam Hussein hated al-Qaeda. He saw them as competitors. Fact of the matter is al-Qaeda is alive and well in Syria right now. But if we send a missile over there, we'll be doing it on their behalf, or at least we'll be helping them out. We will not be lobbing missiles at al-Qaeda. We'll be lobbing missiles at the people that al-Qaeda is fighting against right now. Bashar al-Assad, you know, his government. So anyway, I'm watching this, and then the president says this. Here it goes.
Having made my decision as commander-in-chief based on what I am convinced is our national security interests, I'm also mindful that I'm the president of the world's oldest constitutional democracy. I've long believed that our power is rooted not just in our military might, but in our example as a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And that's why I've made a second decision. I will seek authorization for the use of force from the American people's representatives in Congress.
There you go. And this is, I mean, this is, I'm looking for the you know, where Congress can declare war in the Constitution. Anyhow, it's as you, oh, here we are. Article 1, Section 8, subsection, what, 6? No, that's punishing counterfeiters. Anyway, it's in Article 1. And, he's right. He had made this red line in the sand or red line comment about chemical weapons. And yes, we are signatories to a UN treaty that says that we will not use chemical weapons and that says that any country that does has committed an international crime. But I'm quite sure, I confess, I have not read the entire treaty. But what I do know is if there was even one sentence in it that said that the United States is supposed to enforce this on behalf of the United Nations if any nation violates it, it would have been played on the news over and over and over again, right? So I'm quite sure that there is nothing in the UN Weapons of Mass Destruction Poison Gas Treaty, which goes back, and it's not just that, the UN treaty, I mean, there are international treaties and all kinds of stuff. It goes back to World War I. It was the horrors of World War I. There's nothing in there that says that we are the cops of the world. It's the job of the United States to enforce the law of the world when some country in the world breaks the law. It's sort of like, you know, the state police in Maryland deciding to go into Virginia and arrest some guy shoplifting because he broke the laws of Virginia. Or maybe a better metaphor, the state police in Maryland deciding to go into Virginia to arrest some guy because he broke a federal law, because he was counterfeiting, say. I mean, it doesn't make any sense in my mind. I don't see where our security interests are involved, and I don't see why it is our responsibility to do what the United Nations is supposed to do. I got a real problem with this. I also want to talk to you about maps and oil and pipelines, and I'll do that right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
See, I think there's a reason why we're allowing genocide in Sudan and we're concerned about it in Syria, and I think that reason has something to do with oil. There is no Section 11. Well, there isn't. Welcome back. Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 11. The Congress shall have the power to declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on land and water. It shall have the power to raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money for that use shall be any longer term than 2 years. So, can one of you guys hit this monitor in here so I can see what I'm talking about here? I want to talk about the and then we'll pick up your phone calls. I'm curious to get your thoughts on, you know, what's going on with all this. But I spent some time looking at maps over the weekend. And if I've gone through this before. In fact, back when Bush was talking about war and when we had the war in Iraq, I went through some fairly lengthy explanations about this on this program that deserve revisiting. There is cheap oil and there is expensive oil. And cheap oil is very, very profitable oil, and expensive oil is not so profitable oil. Okay? All over the Midwest, for example, where I grew up in Michigan, there are capped oil wells. There's still oil in the ground. It's just that enough of it has been pumped out that the wells, you know, the pools at the base of the wells are like half full or quarter full. And in order to draw that oil out, you've got to suck really hard on that straw, which means you hook a giant pump up to it. And the pumps are typically run by electricity or gasoline, and the pump then draws the oil up, you know, to the surface and loads it onto a truck and off it goes. And depending on how hard you have to suck on that straw, that depends on whether or not you open that oil well up. I mean, there's oil wells around the Midwest in Pennsylvania and in, from Pennsylvania all the way out to Nebraska, there are oil wells. And many of them down in Texas and Oklahoma, where the cheap oil got pumped out. When the wells were first punched, the oil actually came out under pressure. It didn't cost anything to pump it out. You just had to capture it. Remember the geysers, right? They weren't called geysers. What were they called? When you drill a well and it would just explode oil all over the place. And gushers, yeah, they were called gushers. Back in the day, you know, you see the old pictures from the late 19th century of a bunch of guys standing around with an oil well spraying oil all over the place, and everybody's going, "Woo!" That oil costs nothing to pump, or very little. Might cost 50 cents a gallon or a barrel to pump. But when that well's half empty and you got to suck on that straw, you got to hook a motor up to it, a pump, that oil starts costing $5, $10, $15, $20, $25, $30 a barrel to get out of the ground. Now, when oil is selling for $30 a barrel and it's going to cost you $30 a barrel to suck it out of the ground, that's when you put a cap on the well. When the price of oil goes up to $100 a barrel, that's when you open that well back up. But it's still costing you $30 a barrel to suck it out of the ground. So, in the Middle East, I pulled up this map, this Google map, and in fact, I'm going to forward this off to Sue. I don't know if she can get it in our newsletter and put it in our chat room and all that sort of thing, but I want to get it off to Sue Nethercutt as well. In fact, I'm doing it as I speak. Pulled up this map, and if you look at the western part of Iraq, this is where all these oil wells were that Dick Cheney was having the meetings about in the White House before 9/11. When he was in charge of the Energy Task Force, the Western Iraqi oil fields. As you're looking at the map, it's on the left side of Iraq. That is some of the cheapest and thus most profitable oil in the world, because those oil wells had not been pumped. They had not been what's called developed. You stick a straw in there, and you don't even have to. You know, some cases it just comes out under its own pressure. So that oil is dollar a barrel oil, and you can sell it in the world market for $110, $120, whatever the price of oil is these days. Whereas in Saudi Arabia, it's costing them $15, $20 a barrel to pump oil. Some of their wells are getting up to be costing $40, $50 a barrel. You got other, you know, other oil wells around the region that are $10, $20 a barrel to pump it out. So that's incredibly profitable oil. Now, if you look at that map of Western Iraq, you notice that if you wanted to get that oil out of Iraq, there's really just a couple ways to do it. if you pull back a little bit on the picture, you can go to the south and east, and basically down where Kuwait is, and you can take it into the Persian Gulf. The problem with the Persian Gulf is that Iran controls it. Half of the Persian Gulf is the southern half of Iran. So if you take it to the east, it's kind of dicey. Plus, it's a long way from Europe. But if you want to get that oil to Europe, you want to get it to the Mediterranean. What is between the western border of Iraq, where these cheap oil wells are, these very profitable oil fields that are now being pumped and built by BP and ExxonMobil and Sunoco, as in the Chinese oil company, and on and on and on. What is between that western border of Iraq and the Mediterranean Sea, which basically gets you all the way to Spain on a tanker? Syria. Syria is between the western border oil fields of Iraq and the Mediterranean. Now, you could go south under Syria and kind of make your way over to Israel through Jordan. But that, you know, that's been discussed for years and years, and everybody decided, you know, running oil pipes lines through Israel was not something they were excited about or anybody else. And you could try to go north around Syria, but you'd have to go up into Turkey, and you'd have to go up into the mountains of Turkey and then back down. It's going to get very expensive. But you can run right through the middle of Syria, right from those western Iraqi oil fields into the Mediterranean. I haven't heard a single person talking about this, but it's on my mind.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I might just be a conspiracy theory nut. Who knows? But somehow I think that if the region was principally growing turnips, we wouldn't be having this conversation. 33 and a half minutes, 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And as I was pointing out, Syria is, from Iraq to from the western oil fields of Iraq, which Dick Cheney worked so hard to open up in March and April and May of 2001 before 9/11, when he met with his energy task force and named those oil fields that had never been drilled into, just explored. Just they knew what was there, but they'd never been, used. From the western oil fields of Iraq to the Mediterranean Sea, where you can easily transport that oil to pretty much any place, Portugal, Spain, Italy, France, Austria, Greece, Turkey, of course. There's one thing between those western oil fields of Iraq that are right now being aggressively developed and the Mediterranean Sea, and that one thing is Syria. So, anyhow, something to think about. Congressman Alan Grayson is on the line with us, representing the 9th District of Florida. Congressman with Guts.com, famously, although Don't Attack Syria.com, is a new petition site associated with Congressman Grayson, I believe. Congressman Grayson, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. That petition site is giving people a chance to do something that many people want to do, which is to weigh in on this and express their dissatisfaction with the idea that we're going to get sucked into yet another war in the Middle East.
Yeah. I don't recall any place in the in our treaties or in the United Nations treaties where it says that the United States has the job to enforce international law. Did I miss something?
It's even worse than that, Tom, and I appreciate you almost exclusively helping to try to bring some attention to that important issue. The UN Charter is very clear on this point. One nation should not be attacking another nation unilaterally, whatever the rationale might be. And the administration hasn't even attempted to argue that they're trying to vindicate international law, because they're not. Instead, what they're doing is arguing that they're trying to vindicate an international norm. If you pin them down on that, if you inquire further, what you do is you find out that they're relying on the Convention Against Chemical Weapons, and unfortunately, Syria never signed that convention.
Right.
In international law, you can only enforce treaties and conventions that other countries have signed. So they're left with this very weak argument that there's this norm that they have to enforce. And, of course, international law does not involve the enforcement of norms, but rather the enforcement of laws.
I've been to, recently, I've been to South Sudan, spent a fair amount of time with Salva Kiir, the new president there. And I've been up in the north and on the border with Darfur. I have watched from the air as a village was burned. A good friend of mine went along and adopted, brought back a child whose mother had been taken into slavery. He had been hung upside down and had red hot pepper put in his eyes. He's blind. He's at Perkins School right now. I've seen people I just go on and on. I mean, you know, what is going on in South Sudan, northern South Sudan and Darfur is horrific. I've been in Uganda. I was there during the war with Idi Amin. They've got some problems now. We have terrible problems down in Mr. Mugabe's Mugabe land in Zimbabwe. North Korea is no paragon of, I mean, once we decide that we're the ones who are going to protect innocent people from bad governments, where does it stop?
It doesn't. And if there's one thing that's clear at this point, whatever the humanitarian impulses that certain people may have, it's that Americans don't want to be the world's policeman and can't afford to be the world's policeman. The British government estimated, the American government hasn't bothered to tell us how much this would cost, but the British government estimated this would cost America at least $1 billion, this attack that's being contemplated. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. As you point out, if we're going to attack Syria, then I guess we'll have to attack Burma. If we're going to attack Burma, I guess we'll have to attack Somalia. If we're going to attack Somalia, I guess we're going to have to attack Nigeria. If we're going to attack Nigeria, we're just going to have to attack Mexico.
Well, and I'd put the Democratic Republic of Congo in there, too. I mean, what's going on there? You know, 5 million people. I mean, this is... it just goes on and on and on. And this $1 billion at a time when we're cutting food stamps? Really?
Right. And 20 million Americans are looking for full-time work. And as you point out, 45 million Americans rely upon the government to feed them. How could anybody possibly justify spending $1 billion on lobbing a few missiles into Syria when we know it's not going to lead to an end to the dictatorship? It's not even going to take away their ability to gas their own population in the future.
Right.
It would be at most a slap on the wrist and an ineffective one at that.
We have a long history. You know, Ronald Reagan did it with Grenada, arguably a few other places. Clinton in Bosnia, although, you know, there was an enormous amount of world pressure on that. But we have a long history of presidents wanting to have small, successful wars. George Bush Jr. pointed out that if his father's war had lasted not 3 days, but 30 days or maybe three or 4 months, that he probably would have gotten reelected. And there's this impulse to do this. I'm wondering if you have any interest in speculating about what the motives behind this might be, or if you're simply asserting that there's no reason for us to be there.
Well, the latter. I'm not really interested in doing some kind of proctological examination of the president's motives or Secretary Kerry's motives or anything like that. But yeah. I don't get to vote on their motives. I do get to vote on their plans and their proposals, and I'm going to be voting against it. It's not our responsibility. It won't do any good. It's expensive, and it's dangerous. We attack them, they attack us. Then we're in another war.
Yeah, and I'll make this my final comment, and you can add whatever you'd like. My biggest concern here is, given the fact that Russia and Iran have very substantial interests in the region and treaty interests in the region, as do we and with other countries in the region, that this could have the potential, and I realize it's remote, but it could have the potential to be an Archduke Ferdinand moment. I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Well, much more so than a Neville Chamberlain moment, the way that Secretary Kerry has run around and suggested a Munich moment. Yeah. I give him credit for alliteration, but nothing else.
Yeah.
We have blundered into war before. The most benign explanation of the war in Iraq is that we blundered into it, and that took $4 trillion and 4,000 American lives and 250,000 Iraqi lives for us to extricate ourselves from that. And the same thing could happen all over again. I pointed out to people on several occasions now that the Beirut embassy is a 2-minute MiG flight from the Syrian border. I don't understand why people think we can hit them, but they can't hit us. And of course, that's how wars get started. Iran is already involved. Hezbollah is already involved. The Israelis are to some degree already involved. The Turks are unfortunately involved in being dragged into this, kicking and screaming.
And the Jordanians.
The Jordanians are involved from the fact that they're hosting over 1 million refugees right now, and on and on and on like that. And what we're doing is we're tossing a missile into a tinderbox.
Yeah.
I listen carefully to the arguments that are made in favor of action and what the consequences might be. It seems to me just as likely or more likely that we will see negative consequences instead of positive ones. And I think it's extraordinarily unfortunate that we've had any innocent people dying anywhere, and by, for any cause. A corpse is a corpse, whether it's killed by gas or bullets or bombs. But that simply does not make us responsible for it. We can't afford to be the world's policeman or the world's judge and jury and executioner any longer. And people understand this. You know, what's interesting is not only the number of people who are against this, as the polls reflect, but the intensity of their feeling. The fact that in almost no time we'd have 25,000 people come to the DonAttackSyria.com website and put their name down. And these are people who are going to be calling their congressmen. They're people who are going to be emailing their congressmen. They're people who realize that we're at a moment now. We're at a turning point. And we have to get past this idea that every time we see something we don't like, we bomb it.
Right. Yeah. It's the old Abe Maslow, you know, when the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. We've got a very, very good hammer in our military. And we should be having a hammer in building schools and building, you know, other things. But
well, you know, we call it the Department of Defense.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to defend Americans and our allies. No Americans have been attacked here. None of our allies have been attacked here. And whatever we do that's being contemplated now is not going to really, in the end, alleviate anyone's suffering or avoid anyone's suffering. If anything, it could extend and prolong and magnify the agony. We have a situation right now where there's been a civil war going on for several years. It's beyond our ability to end it. It's going to continue regardless. It's becoming a proxy battle between Sunni crazies and Shiite crazies. I don't feel any particular need to intervene in a battle like that. I think most people would say a plague on both their houses.
Yeah, it's like a bunch of guys sitting in a basement or standing in a basement up to their ankles in gasoline yelling at each other, and we walk in with a hand grenade.
Yeah.
Congressman Alan Grayson, DontAttackSyria.com, and of course Grayson.House.gov and CongressmanWithGuts.com. Congressman, thank you so much for the great work you're doing.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for great work, too.
Thanks for being with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
There are a few people who tell it like it is, the way that Congressman Alan Grayson does. We'll be right back. Welcome back to our program, brought to you in part by Carbonite.com, offer code Tom. And welcome back. Thank you so much for being with us. Michael in Northport, New York. Hey, Michael, thanks for listening to WWRL. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I've got a few points I wanted to talk to you about with respect to the arguments you've been making.
Pick one, please.
Sure. Well, okay.
Michael, your phone is just disintegrating on you.
Can you hear me?
Sort of. Try saying something. Make your point.
Can you hear me?
Just try making your point. Let's see if it works.
Sure. The argument that we can't act because the UN hasn't authorized it, that would be a good argument if the reason the UN didn't authorize it was because they didn't know if the Syrian government had been responsible for the chemical weapons, or they didn't know if the chemical weapons actually had even taken place. But we know that's not the reason the UN isn't going to authorize it. The reason the UN wouldn't authorize it is because of Russia. It's because of political reasons, not
Well, and it's not just political. It's geopolitical and it's petropolitical. Let me just push back on what you said. As Congressman Grayson pointed out, he didn't do it on this program, but he did it very well on television yesterday. The intelligence that John Kerry has shared with us, the intelligence that was presented in the classified briefings and that has been declassified as well, suggests that members of the Syrian military knew about the gassing. That does not mean that it was ordered by the Syrian military, and it does not mean that it was ordered by Bashar al-Assad. But even if it was, it's not our business.
Well, I disagree with that in the sense that I think the United States does have a role, and I think international law.
What role?
The role of preventing humanitarian disasters. Now, if that
then you've got half the world right now living on less than $2 a day. You've got 2 billion people right now on this planet who do not have access to clean water or sanitation. You got 50,000 children a day dying simply because of dirty water. Why are we not doing something about that? If that's our role,
Tom,
if our role is a humanitarian role.
Tom, I listen to you all the time, and I know deep down you don't. I don't know if liberals will buy this argument, because you could make this argument for everything. Why help the poor when there are middle class people struggling? Why invest in food stamps?
No, you're creating a straw man or distorting my words. I'm not sure which, but my point is, Michael, that if we decide that we should have a humanitarian role in the world, and I think we should, then we should have a foreign policy that is designed to heal people and to feed people and to promote democracy. But we should not have a foreign policy, in my opinion, that is designed to kill people and blow things up unless we've been attacked. And we have not been attacked by Syria.
So just to make my final point, which is that there are very good arguments not to invade Syria. For example, the oil pipeline arguments you've been making. If our actions and our rationale aren't actually legitimate, if they are to increase our oil or to increase geopolitical reasons, then it's a completely illegitimate invasion or use of force. But if our actions are for humanitarians, or if they really are for humanitarian reasons, I think
it's still illegitimate. It is still illegitimate. If we are going in there because a bad guy did some bad things to his people, to his good people, to innocent children, and, you know, whether it's 1,400 people killed by poison gas or 4 million refugees and probably 100,000 dead, 4 million refugees displaced, if we go in for humanitarian purposes with our military, where does it stop? I could make a very good case, Michael, and I would have no problem. In fact, I'd be pleased to make that case that we should be providing security to the refugee camps in Jordan and in Turkey. We should be providing food and medicine to the refugee camps in Jordan and Turkey. We should be doing everything we can. I mean, you know, many of these refugees are now starting to go back to Syria because the camps have become hellholes. The water's no good. They're starting to have cholera epidemics. It's just horrible stuff is going on there. We should be providing security and food. I'm all about that.
Tom, would those measures have prevented, let's say, the Rwandan genocide? I mean, I think we all agree that we should have used military force in Rwanda.
I do not agree with that.
Made a big mistake. You don't? Okay.
No.
Well, I think many liberals would agree that the United States, if we can do something, we should.
I believe that had we had a rational foreign policy in the first place, when the British, and in the case of Rwanda, the Belgians, as I recall, pulled out of the region, had we gone in and strengthened democratic institutions and built schools and helped build the infrastructure for both business and democracy, the Rwandan genocide never would have happened.
Definitely. That's 100% true. But the question is, in this world, when there's a genocide taking place and we didn't take the
so let's take, you know, we have limited amounts of money, let's take that money and instead of putting it into Tomahawk missiles, Let's put it into building those schools. Let's put it into building those hospitals. And right now, in the present emergency, let's put it into building refugee camps. I mean, I was in northern Uganda in 1980 and 1981, literally building refugee camps. I helped build a refugee camp of refugees, the Keramajong people from the Keramoja region of northern Uganda, as a consequence of Idi Amin's men having gone through and slaughtered every male over the age of 10 and raped most of the women. And we had all these women and all these little babies and all these very young children. And it was an absolute disaster. And I was literally, on several days driving a bulldozer. We were building mass graves because people were dying from kwashiorkor, from starvation. We should be doing, not building mass graves, God forbid, but we should be in there feeding those refugees. That's important work. That's God's work. But dropping bombs, taking out, you know, I do not see how in asserting ourselves militarily when we have not been attacked and we have no legal basis for it is going to advance the interests of the United States or of peace in the world. And those are my two criteria. Michael, thank you for the call. I understand your outrage, you know, your moral outrage. Everybody's upset, rightfully. But what's the appropriate response?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back and greetings to our newest affiliates, our newest Pacific affiliates, KPFK Live, KPFK FM 90.7 in Los Angeles, KNSJ FM 89.1 in San Diego, KBBF FM 89.1 in San Francisco, KBCS FM 91.3 in Seattle, and KXRY FM 91.1 in Portland. We continue as the program continues to grow. President Leo Gerard is with us, the International President of the United Steelworkers, USW.org is the website. One of the most thoughtful and insightful people that I know in the labor movement. President Gerard, it's always an honor to have you with us. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's an honor to be on your show. It's a great show.
Thank you. Time to supersize those wages. Labor Day was this past weekend. We celebrated Labor Day. And increasingly, we're seeing now, quote, low-wage workers stepping out and saying, we're working our butts off, in some cases two and three jobs, and we still have to rely on food stamps to live. This should not be happening in the United States of America. Your thoughts on this?
Well, look, I think it's a tragedy, and this is a big industry that's very profitable, and you know, we're talking about the Yum Yum brands that people don't even know they exist in many cases, that own a number of different fast food outlets, including Taco Bell and Kentucky Fried Chicken and things like that. Then you got McDonald's and you got others. You know, you take the McDonald's CEO, I don't know if you saw it, that the McDonald's CEO got with Visa and they did a budget for a low-wage worker. That what the budget says, if you can work 80 hours a week,
yeah,
and have $20 a month for your health care and don't buy any food or don't buy any clothes, you could probably make it all right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, we...
Then you go to Walmart, and this is something that really jumped out at me. The average Walmart store, because they pay their people so little, is subsidized to the tune of about $1.7 million from Medicaid and food stamps on average per store. That's not counting the extracted tax breaks they get from the region and all of that kind of stuff. So this is not an industry that couldn't afford to pay people decent wages. And when you use Walmart, you can just compare it to Costco. People at Costco at least have a living wage.
Yeah. So what is the, in your mind, what is the state of labor in America today and why?
I think labor is, in this case, I agree with President Rich Trumka of the AFL-CIO. I'm not sure if I'd say crisis, but I'd say tipping point, that the labor movement has been under attack since Ronald Reagan. That attack has been heightened by the extremism of right-wing Republicans, It's been exacerbated by the big money able to buy elections, in particular at the state level and congressional level. They weren't able to buy the presidency, thank God. But at the state level, and they've been expanding at state level again, right to work laws. And I've had occasion to talk about right to work, and we're to be blamed for letting them steal the language and making people in the general public believe this is about jobs. It's not a right to a job. What it is an attack on the labor movement, and you couldn't get away with this in any other part of society, because what it says is that if there's a union in the facility, you can decide not to pay union dues. But if the union negotiates an improvement in benefits, in pensions, in wages, then you're entitled to get that benefit. And if by some freak of nature you were to get disciplined or have some workplace issue from your boss or your foreman, and you came to the union would have to represent you, or it would be an unfair labor practice. So this has nothing to do with jobs. It has nothing to do with work. It has everything to do with weakening unions' ability to do collective bargaining. Then you take on top of that, and I don't want to go on and on, but if you take on top of that, America has the weakest labor laws of any major industrialized country. And with the way I characterize it, you have the right to try to get a union, and the boss has the right to do anything they can to stop you. Should you win the right to get a union through a voting process, then the boss has every right to try and stop you from getting a collective agreement. And the worst thing that happens to the boss is they're told to go do it again. So those are all the factors, and I think we have to understand that it's a problem, and we have to get with allies who share our values and build a response to that. It's eroding the middle class. It's exacerbating the gap between the rich and the rest of us. We have the highest incidence of childhood poverty now since the Great Depression. I mean, all of that stuff. We got kids coming out of college with college debt that's equal to the first mortgage on a house. I mean, the whole system is breaking down, Tom.
It seems to me, President Girard, that the original sin, if we were to point to one, and I love to, everybody loves to point to Reagan's busting of Patco and installing the first Secretary of Labor who's actually hostile to labor. But it seems that the real original sin, the original metastasized cancer cells, pick your favorite lousy metaphor, was Taft-Hartley. And I have not heard anybody in a long, long time. I mean, I'm doing an op-ed on TV about it tonight, about how it's time to roll back Taft-Hartley. But it seems like this has been completely forgotten. I mean, it was 1947 when that happened.
Yeah.
Is there any serious, effort to do anything about Taft-Hartley? And if so, where do I sign up?
Well, the answer is probably not. Although we should have, the closest that would come to repealing Taft-Hartley or making inroads against its aggression would be the last attempt on the Employee Free Choice Act. And once again, it failed to get the requisite 60 votes because we had three Democrats that waffled on us. And we weren't able to get there. The fact is, I think that you're raising a very valid point. I think that we need to understand that everyone who is trying to advance the cause of the ordinary folks, not the rich and the already powerful, whether you're trial lawyers, whether you're the women's movement, whether you're the voting rights movement, whether you're the social justice movement, whether you're the labor movement, whether you're environmental movement, whether you're the students movement, every one of them is under attack by the current structure that we've got, where money buys politicians, and that the fact of the matter is that it's the most hostile, anti-progressive environment there is. When they start to attack the president for wanting to reduce the student loans, for example, when they refuse to put in high-speed rail because it could end up costing money. I mean, we're right now, America's infrastructure is falling apart, and that goes with the labor movement. That goes with income inequality. That goes with all of those things. And so my view is maybe you got the right approach. Maybe we need to go all the way back to Taft-Hartley and start to go on the offensive about repealing Taft-Hartley. repealing right to work in too many places where we've had right to work and we've had Democratic administrations at the state level. Mm-hmm. We didn't go on the offensive to get it repealed.
Yeah, if you repeal Taft-Hartley, then the right to work for less laws would become invalid, would they not?
Yeah.
And
you know, there's just so much of that, and you know, this may sound like heresy, but I think we've reached a point where the attacks from the extreme right have become so sort of omnipresent and bankrolled by such big money in the political system that no one who's for a progressive future for our kids and grandkids, no institution can do this on their own. We have to come together as we've never come together before. And if you look at, we just celebrated the 50th anniversary in the March on Washington. And the 50th anniversary on the March on Washington was working people led by Walter Reuther, led by A. Philip Randolph, led by Dr. Martin Luther King.
Yep.
And we put together...
Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Very sorry. 10 seconds, sir. President Leo Girard, USW.org. Thank you so much for being with us, President.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Somehow, John Kerry has taken the position that what Obama is requesting, and I quote John Kerry himself, our Secretary of State, a man that I worked and voted for. I didn't work for, like, for money, but I mean, I encouraged people to vote for in 2004, and I voted for President of the United States. And frankly, who I think probably won the election. John Kerry, who had the courage after he came back from Vietnam to speak out against that war and to ask that question, who should be the last man to die for a mistake or for a lie, said that what President Obama is suggesting is, quote, nothing like going to war. How is dropping bombs on people not like going to war? I mean, we have right now in the United States cities that are going down the tubes. You've got Detroit, the art museum in Detroit. They're going to auction off the art museum so that Rick Snyder's fat cap buddies can get some treasures that have been off the market for a long, long time. You got Belle Isle. The libertarian billionaires want to buy it and create a little libertarian paradise. You've got the city water system that they want to privatize. You've got we have, you know, 40 million Americans who are working, who are making so little because of the tragedy of the way capitalism is run in this country that they have to have food stamps in order to be able to get by. And of them, millions of them have no access to health care. And we're going to spend billions of dollars dropping bombs on another country in a way that could well lead us to have to spend trillions of dollars in a long and protracted war in a region that's got nothing to do with us? Or at least if we could get 70% of the cars in the United States that travel less than 50 miles a day on average converted to electric cars, we would no longer need to import any oil from overseas. I mean, this is just crazy. In my opinion, you know, respectfully, I get the incredible pressures that this president is under, but I think it's wrong. PJ in Jacksonville, Florida. Hey, PJ, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, I'm a staunch Democrat, and I totally support President Obama on this.
Why?
I mean, I think that it's a little bit too late now to do anything, but, you know, I'm having a hard time with the hypocrisy of liberals concerning weapons of mass destruction. And the reason I say that, here is why it is so clear to me that we should be supporting this. We, the people of the world, got together, you know, with the UN and all that. 98% of the people in the world that we decided that we were not, we were absolutely going to strictly prohibit nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, biological weapons, and radioactive weapons.
Let me add to that, PJ, if I may, if you're invoking
okay.
UN treaties. We also agreed that no country would attack another country unless one of two things had happened. Either one, that country had first been attacked or was demonstrably, imminently going to be attacked. Or, secondly, the United Nations voted to authorize that attack. Now, neither of those things have happened with Syria.
I understand that. But a lot of other things have happened with Syria, and
none of them have involved us.
Well, no, nothing about Syria involves us. And the entire civil war and all of that stuff that's going on over there, and, you know, it's really a war by proxy. It's a world war by proxy is what it looks like to me.
It will become one if we involve ourselves.
Yes. And I believe that as far as...
So why would you want that?
I don't.
But you said you want to be involved. You want the United States to involve itself in Syria, and to a small extent.
I support President Obama. That I believe that I think that what happened because of this whole thing.
Hang on just a second, PJ. Let's clarify terms. I support President Obama in putting this to Congress. I disagree with his position, and I hope Congress says no, and I hope he respects that. Is that what you're saying, too, or are you saying that you agree with President Obama that he has the authority and should use that authority to attack Syria with or without Congress, or that you hope that Congress gives him the authority to attack Syria? But let's clarify our terms here.
Okay, well, the thing is, it's moving so fast. I agree that he should have done it last week and then come out and said, this is what I did. I think he should have gone in there and he should have attacked those military, where the rockets came from.
By what authority?
On what authority?
Yes. I mean, well, let me ask the question another way. If Russia decided, Russia's probably a bad example, because what the heck. If Russia decided that they didn't like the way that we were doing things, all the protests against their anti-gay laws or something, and they decided to, say, bomb a couple square blocks of New York City, by what authority would they do that?
That's not the same thing, because we didn't use weapons of mass destruction against anybody.
Okay, let's say that Canada decided... Yeah, you're right. That was a terrible example.
Right.
Let's say that Canada decided that our public executions of prisoners were inhumane, and they decided to invade the United States. What would their basis be for that?
It's all about the weapons. If we're going to stand up as the people of this world, and we're going to say we will not allow those weapons, and then we don't enforce it, then why are we even bothering to make
hang on just a second.
Tom Hartman program. Call 866-987-THOM.
PJ, if the we was the United Nations, I agree with you. But we, the United States, did not commit to the world that we would stop people from using those weapons. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. And Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, what's on? You want to talk about Syria?
Yes, Tom. But first I have a question for you. Last week you were saying that about Colin Powell when he went in front of the UN. And I had always figured I was about 90% sure that he actually knew all the time that information wasn't true. But you said that there was proof that he knew that information wasn't true. How did you find that out?
By talking to Lawrence Wilkerson on my television program, who was his assistant. And, I'd have to go back and find it and play it for you to give you the exact words. But the essence of it was that Colin Powell believed much of what he said, was doubtful about much of what he said, and was fairly certain that at least a few of the things he was saying probably weren't true. Wilkerson actually cuts him a fair amount of slack, and I'm willing to, too. I think that there's a I don't think that Colin Powell, if he had known that, you know, the magnitude of the lies that he was telling, I don't think he would have done it, because I don't think he would want that place in history. I don't think he wants the place in history that he has. But
so you think the 10% he knew wasn't true, or 15%?
See, I don't know what the percentage is, but the fact of the matter is that if even one lie was told, leading to the death of hundreds of thousands of people, the dislocation of millions of people, the loss of trillions of dollars in wealth and opportunity, both for Americans and Iraqis, a country covered with depleted uranium and massively spiking in birth defects, when you consider the horrific consequences of that, and Colin Powell is, to his credit, probably the only man in the administration who actually raised those kinds of questions. But when you consider that, I think that, if we were having war trial crimes, tribunals about the war in Iraq, I think that Colin Powell should be in the dock as well. I don't think that he should get the same penalty that the guys who were aggressively lying did. I think he was used as much as he was participating in it. But he had an opportunity to back out. He had an opportunity to say, hey, wait a minute, I want to know more. Prove this to me, and he chose not to.
Right. Okay, as far as Syria is concerned, you bringing up those gas pipelines.
Yes, sir.
I had brought it up last week on a couple of shows, but people are kind of like on the war wagon, so they weren't really interested.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that I'm going to tell you what I really think. I think this is a false flag operation. I think the rebels are the ones who dropped those chemical weapons on those people. Like you said yourself, Al-Qaeda is armed up with the Syrian, the native Syrian, will fight against the Assad government.
Well, here's a very possible scenario, Wayne, that I have not, that everything I've read and seen and heard from Secretary Kerry and the intelligence briefings and people who members of Congress who attended the private intelligence briefings have said in public, that actually I think is a possibility. And that is that it was people within Assad's government who did it, that they did it intentionally, and that they did it because they oppose Assad and they wanted to get the attention of the world. I mean, keep in mind, they did it just before the UN inspectors were scheduled to be there. And, you know, they did it so that we would respond by taking out Assad. I mean, there was a bunch of people in his government who quit, you'll recall, you know, who left his government, who went over and joined the rebels. Why wouldn't there be people inside his government who are trying to sabotage his government by killing a couple thousand people using chemical weapons?
Exactly. Well,
And then we listen in on it and we go, oh, look at General so-and-so knew about it. In fact, he participated in it. Well, maybe he did. Maybe he did because he wants to take out Assad, not because he's Assad's best friend.
Exactly. So that's what I'm saying. The United States is trying to blame Assad, and they still don't really know exactly who did it. But this is my real point. Like you say, they want to run that pipeline. They don't want Iran, Iraq, and Syria, as they are constituted now, that's a Shiite stronghold pipeline. They don't want that. So Qatar wants that, and Saudi Arabia wants it, United States, Europe. They want that pipeline to go through Syria, through Turkey, into Europe. Yeah. And also, remember when the Russians had a big thing with Europe, and they cut the faucet off to the natural gas. Remember that?
Oh, yeah, through Ukraine, I think it was, yeah.
Right, so they don't want that to happen again. They want to eliminate Russia as much as possible. Europe does, as far as cutting the faucet off on the natural gas, especially in the wintertime.
Yep.
So this is all geopolitical and oil and money. That's the main reason why they want to go into Syria. And one last thing. We got to be crazy if we're Americans and call ourselves a democracy to give any president to stand up and say, I have the right to go into a country and drop bombs just on my own, whether Congress agrees with me or not. It's a violation of the Constitution. Actually, it's a violation of international law for us to even go into Syria in the first place, and it's a violation of the Constitution. Right. Only Congress has the right to declare war. It's crazy for us to let one man say, I can do this, I have the right to do this.
I agree. Unless that one, well, not even unless. The only circumstances under which there should be an attack on Syria is if the United Nations says, these are the, you know, these are the treaties, these are the laws, we passed these laws, we're going to enforce these laws. And as Congressman Grayson pointed out, Syria did not sign on for those laws, so arguably they did not break the law, because it was done entirely within Syria. If Syria dropped gas weapons on a country that was a signatory to the law, then they would have broken the law, but they didn't. So, but none of this is or should be the business of the United States. Wayne, thank you for the call. I don't disagree with your theory on the oil. In fact, that's why I brought it up. Tony in New York City. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
I have two questions and an observation. My first question is, if, you know, America decides, or, the, you know, America doesn't get their approval to go into Syria and, you know, perform this operation, and some time passes and, you know, chemical weapons are used again repeatedly, you know, do you think your opinion would change on whether someone should get involved and prevent the use of chemical weapons?
Or I've been saying all along someone should get involved. I think that here's the way I think this should have played out. The president of the United States should have flown over to Russia, sat down and said, we're not going to argue about Snowden anymore, and sat down with Vladimir Putin and said, let's put together a bilateral U.S.-Russian inspection office under the auspices of the United Nations as two of the Security Council members. Invite the Chinese in, too. Invite the French in, too. And we will go to Syria, and we're going to find out just exactly what the hell is going on. And if we can achieve a consensus and we can all participate in this, then we will decide how we're going to respond, and we're going to try in very hard to respond in a way that does not change the geopolitics of the region. What Wayne was just referring to a moment ago. I mean, you used to have Iraq as a Sunni stronghold. It is now Shia. Shia, which is Iran. Iraq is now one of Iran's closest allies. That's got a lot of people in the region, and particularly a lot of people in the oil business, freaked out. Assad is, Syria right now is, there's a lot of Shiites in the country, but he's an Alawite. He's allied himself, to a large extent, not with the Sunnis, because the Sunnis are fighting against him, but the Shias basically want to take over the country. And it's like I can't speak for Russia's concerns. I don't know what they are explicitly, but my guess would be that they don't want to see the geopolitical balance of the region changed, that it's relatively stable right now. And if the whole thing goes Shiite, it all goes crazy, because you've got all these Sunni smaller countries, Qatar and Saudi Arabia and whatnot, that have aligned themselves largely with the West. The Shia countries are aligning themselves more with Russia. And so, if our agreement from the get-go was, whatever we do, if we take out Assad, we'll replace him with somebody who's essentially politically the same, or if we, punish him, we'll do it in a way that doesn't change his government. This is why I think the president keeps saying it's not about regime change. I think that's a signal to the Russians that we're not trying to do what Bush did in Iraq and Afghanistan. But I think that he should be leading on this, and he should get the Russians involved with this. It's my personal opinion.
To follow up on that, and let's say Russia and China just didn't come to the table, and there was no negotiations, would there still be a time or a place when it is appropriate for the United States to step in and say, we've had enough of this, you can't do this?
I don't think there is ever a time or place for the United States to involve itself in somebody else's civil war. Unless it's happening on our borders. If Canada or Mexico were involved in a civil war, maybe.
Okay, so let's say it's going to another country. and other, and you know, other countries in the region begin using chemical
weapons. This is what you're describing is the World War I scenario. And there are still a lot of people, David Swanson, one of the best out there, saying, you know, we never should have gone into World War I. Tony, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
See, I mean, it's a simple question. Why should the United States involve itself in this? What is our interest in this? And what is the legal basis for that? Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you. Frank in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank. Syria? Frank? No, Frank. He did pot. Okay. Frank's apparently. Okay, let's go to Wayne in Granby, Mass. Hey, Wayne, what's up?
Hi, Tom, and by the way, welcome back.
Thank you.
I was just thinking, it seems like I believe the entire 20th century up to and including this Afghanistan and possibly what we're going to get into with Syria, except for World War II, has been against countries who have never attacked us.
Right.
That's a lousy track record as far as I'm concerned. I'd like you to comment.
I don't disagree with you. The Vietnam was a horrible mistake. Grenada was, you know, Reagan just did that because Thatcher did it in Argentina and her popularity went up and he thought he'd do the same thing. The George Bush planned the war in Iraq before he was even elected because he thought it would get him reelected and he thought it would give him the political popularity to privatize Social Security. And he, you know, he told his autobiographer that, the guy who ghostwrote his book. War after war, lie after lie. I mean, even Kuwait. You know, George Bush Sr., we went into Kuwait because the daughter of the ambassador of Kuwait got up in front of America and lied. First of all, didn't say that she was the daughter of the ambassador. And secondly, said, oh, the soldiers are throwing babies out of these electric, what do you call them, preemie things, you know, whatever they're called, incubators. And it was a lie. It wasn't actually happening. And Americans were like horrified. I mean, oh, the children. Right. And then I'm watching TV on Sunday and over the weekend. And here's Ann Curry reporting for NBC. She just came back from the Syrian refugee camps and she's like, they're hell. Well, I've worked in refugee camps. They are hell. But that doesn't mean that you go bomb somebody. You feed people. You provide security to the refugee camps. You're absolutely right, Wayne. We have not been invaded. We've not been attacked. And in a long, long time, with the exception of Pearl Harbor, and anyway, Mark in Chico, California. Hey, Mark.
Hi, Tom. Nice to have you back.
You're Thank
looking
you.
Good. You know, I could be just thinking of conspiracies, but you know, we were supposed to have this a long debate on the NSA. And all these all this new stuff about the DEA and all that,
yep.
That's coming out. Is this kind of like to take us off track on that?
I'm not sure the correlation is causation, but that is the consequence. That is what's going on. And you're right. The DEA is running a phone tapping operation that makes the NSA look like amateurs. And it's not being discussed in the corporate media either. It's not being discussed, you know, broadly. And what Ed Snowden, his revelations, all these things, they're very convenient distractions. Wars are always very convenient distractions. And you've got all these people living in poverty. You've got people protesting, you know, going out on strike against McDonald's and whatnot. There's a lot of things going on. That the corporate fat cats would just assume you didn't know about, just so long as you give them a little more money for a few more Tomahawk missiles. Excellent point. Jerry in Long Island. Hey, Jerry, you wanted to comment on Syria.
Yeah, I want to comment on Syria. Well, let me give you a heads up. I mean, usually I'm on the same page with you. Here I have areas of agreement and disagreement. My areas of agreement, obviously, are that, first of all, no one, including myself, wants the boots of American troops on the ground in Syria. And I do have concerns about the collateral damage to innocent civilians from the cruise missiles. No one seems to be talking about that.
Yes.
But Assad is one of the worst, and he's one of the most infamous and one of the most butcherous mass-murdering dictators alive in the Middle East today, and he's responsible already for the deaths of literally hundreds of thousands of his fellow countrymen through conventional weapons. That's before we even get to the issue of chemical weapons.
Well, the best estimate is around 100,000, but we don't know how many of those were killed by him and how many of them were killed by the rebels. But all of that, I don't disagree with any of that. Why is the Arab League not involved?
Well, the Arab League has come. Well, the Arab League is playing it cute. They've said that they do want action against Assad, but they don't spell out exactly what form they think that action should take. But I do think that, being indifferent and just sitting back and doing nothing is not a solution. You had an earlier caller who mentioned Rwanda, and I think the world should never again allow what happened in Rwanda to occur in Syria, where you have mass murder, and then you have people sitting back, the international community doing virtually nothing and allowing that mass murder to continue. I mean, even Bill Clinton has second thoughts about not getting involved in Rwanda, although he did get us involved in the Balkans for humanitarian reasons against that ethnic cleansing monster Milosevic, who was eventually put on trial in The Hague. And maybe that's what we should do with respect to Assad eventually. I don't think that we should.
What we should do with respect to Assad right now. I mean, let's get a consensus that he should be held before The Hague. Let's get some countries together. Let's go in, run a SEAL team operation like we did against Bin Laden. Take Assad out, bring him to the Hague, and put him in front of a court.
Right, I'm fine with that, but in the meantime, there'll still be a lot of his henchmen left in power. I do think I was initially against the no-fly zone. I think that might be needed to help protect innocent Syrian civilians
You were initially against what? I'm sorry, I didn't hear the word.
The no-fly zone.
Oh, the no-fly zone.
Initially, yeah, to help protect innocent Syrian civilians from Assad's airstrikes on them.
Yeah.
And even if we remove him, he's still going to have henchmen in power who may still continue airstrikes on civilians. I think we need to protect civilians. I do think we need to actually deliver to the U.S. trusted non-Al-Qaeda Syrian opponents of Assad the weapons we promised them months ago.
If Turkey, which is, a lot of these civilians who have fled Syria are in Turkey and in Jordan, the two countries that border to the north and south of Syria. If those countries say to us, will you please provide us with no-fly zones over our territory, we should do that. They're allies. If those countries say, will you please help feed, the refugees and provide tents and camps, we should do that. I'm not opposed to that. As much as I think that we should be feeding our own hungry people first, we should still do that. You're right. It's a humanitarian crisis. But the hammer of bombs is not appropriate to the nail of Assad in my mind, and it's not legal. So, anyway, Jerry, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, the latest poll out, more than half of Americans oppose a strike on Syria by the United States. This is interesting. As I want to repeat my original comment. And that is that the president believes that he has given the precedent that was established by the presidents who preceded him, presumably going back to Nixon, that he has the authority as commander-in-chief of the military to attack Syria for using chemical weapons against their own people. I personally don't believe he has that authority, and I have not seen any legal documentation coming out of this administration which supports that assertion, to my satisfaction. But I'm not the guy he's got to convince. He's got to convince 535 members of Congress. While I disagree with the president's position that he has the power to do this and that he should do it, And I disagree with John Kerry's assertion that it should be done, and I disagree with Chuck Hagel's assertion that it should be done. What I do genuinely honor and respect is that this president, even though he is strongly asserting, and I think he believes it to be true, that he doesn't need to, has chosen to do the path that the Constitution requires, which is to ask the people's representatives what they think. Here is how he said it on, what was it, Saturday or Sunday? It was this weekend, Saturday, when he came out, and I just before he started speaking, he was about a half hour late coming to the microphone, and I turned to Louise and I said, you know, he's not going to come out until the bombs start falling, right? I mean, we've seen this movie before. And she was like, boy, I hope not. And he made the whole rationale for attacking Syria. The world is watching. It's a horrible thing that they did. We can't let this genie out of the bottle, that kind of thing. And then he said this.
Having made my decision as commander-in-chief based on what I am convinced is our national security interests, I'm also mindful that I'm the president of the world's oldest constitutional democracy. I've long believed that our power is rooted not just in our military might, but in our example as a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And that's why I've made a second decision. I will seek authorization for the use of force from the American people's representatives in Congress.
Which is exactly what the Constitution in Article 1, Section 8, Line 11, calls for. Only Congress has the authority to make war. And for that matter, only the Congress has the authority to fund the machinery of war, and they can not do that for any longer than a two-year period, which tells you what the framers of the Constitution thought about a military-industrial complex. So I have to say, I am very proud of my president, and I think we all should be, that he decided to take the constitutional path and say, you know, this should not be one man's choice. If we're talking about the death of even one person, I mean, you know, you're entitled to a jury of your peers, not a judge, but a jury, if you're charged with a crime. And here he is charging another country with a crime. That jury should be the 535 members of Congress, and they should be reacting in response to what we the people are saying to them. So I honor and respect the president for putting this before the American people, before the elected representatives of the American people. I find it astounding that the Republicans have said that they're going to stay on vacation for another week before they come back and talk about this. And then they go on Fox News and go, oh, look, and he's weak and vacillating. He's going to take another week to figure out what to do. But no, we don't want to go back. I got to go to Hawaii for a couple days or whatever. Right. But I guess that's pretty much the extent to which I'm going to politicize this. And in large part, it's because I disagree with the president's initial assertion that he can and should do this. And my disagreement is based on a couple of very simple principles. Number one, nobody attacked us. Under international law and national law, we have the right to defend ourselves. And in fact, we even have the right to defend ourselves against imminent attack. If 100,000 troops were amassing on the Canadian border, we would have the right to attack them, even before they crossed the border, if we could demonstrate that that was their intent. But that has not happened. So, number one, nobody has attacked us. There has been no Pearl Harbor here. George Bush at least tried to pretend that 9/11 was a Pearl Harbor, even though Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with it whatsoever. George Bush, at least he understood he had to pretend that America had been attacked by Saddam Hussein. And to this day, more than half of people who watch Fox TV think that Saddam Hussein had something to do with Al-Qaeda and something to do with the attack on 9/11, even though it's totally not true. Bush felt he needed to perpetuate that lie. This president has not tried the big lie on us. I respect that. He hasn't argued that a law has been broken, an international law has been broken. Syria is not a signatory to the chemical biological weapons treaty that outlaws the use of such things. So Syria technically has not broken any laws. And beyond that, you know, if you're going to get upset about a country killing its own people, they gassed 1,500 people, they killed another 100,000. And they got another couple million refugees. Or if you want to get all hysterical about Al-Qaeda, you know, like Charles Krauthammer likes to do, why is it that the anti-Assad forces are heavily infiltrated with Al-Qaeda? I mean, we are talking about kicking a hornet's nest, stepping into the middle of something. I mean, pick your cliche. But number one, we have no legal authority to do this. Number two, it is not in the best interests of the United States to do this. Now, you could argue that it was in the best interests of the United States to involve ourselves in the Balkan War. I'm not quite sure how you could argue that, but Bill Clinton seemed to make that argument. Or you could argue that, you know, in Libya, we were executing, you know, we were part of NATO and NATO had said, yes, let's do it. And so we said, okay, cool, we'll participate. But here we stand alone. NATO is not with us. England is not with us. The United Nations is not with us. The Arab League is not with us. So the question, who made us the police officers for the world? Is it really our job to look at countries that are violating laws or behaving badly and to fix that problem by bombing them? And if it is, will bombing them fix the problem? What's the end game here? What do we do if we bomb Assad and he, in response, throws a missile at, as Congressman Grayson pointed out, our embassy in Beirut? What then?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, there are so many what thens. There are so many how this could goes that, like I said, I am very concerned this could play out like World War I did. Well, and now 20 minutes past the hour, now John Kerry has come out and said, well, if Syria implodes, we might have to send soldiers in there. No boots on the ground, but maybe boots on the ground. Jason in D.C. Hey, Jason, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? I'm really looking forward to this vote because, to me, it's going to be a litmus test about people who stand by their principles and those who are basically partisan type of players. I think this vote that is going to come down is going to look a lot like the NSA Amash amendment vote, and it's going to probably be split. And you're going to have these group of people. You know, you've got Obama and the Lindsey Grahams and the John McCains and Nancy Pelosi's on one side. And, you know, you've got these other people on the other that are against this sort of position. So I think this is going to be very eye-opening for the American public because I don't think the president was counting on the amount of pushback that the American public was having.
I think he may well have been counting on it, and I think he may well have said, let's put this before Congress because I don't really want to do this.
You know, it's kind of like the other day I caught my daughter with her hand in the cookie jar, and the moment I caught her with the cookie, she said, can I have a cookie?
Right.
I think Obama was moving forward with this sort of stuff, and then suddenly people came to him and goes, holy moly, there's a lot more resistance than we were thinking on this. You better do something about this. But obviously we're going to wait to see how this plays out. But the most startling thing about this, though, again, is the fact that if you switch the names out and I took Obama, covered up the name and read off the situation and people thought it was Bush or vice versa, I'm just amazed at how both people on either side of the aisle constantly just fold into it. Well, if it's my guy, it's okay. If it's your guy, I'm against it. And that's why I want this vote to go through.
Yeah.
Because I really
agree. As I said this earlier, Jason, there are going to be some people who are going to vote this as a partisan vote for or against the president. There are other people who are going to be voting it based on their interpretation of the national interests of the United States. And it will allow us to see who are the statesmen and stateswomen and who are the political hacks, for lack of a better word, and regardless of which side you come down on this. And I think your analysis is right. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I want to bring up a couple of points that were made on Democracy Now! By a British expert, and I don't remember his name. I wish I did. But he said, what would be the strategic advantage of Assad to use these chemical weapons if, in fact, what's going to happen is he's going to have this reaction from the United States? And he did say, which has been, you know, the federal government or the Obama administration said that the opposition could not do this, but he disagreed with that and said that they could find the weaponry to launch chemical weapons. And also, there has been a big pushback from Syrian nationals and Syrian Americans to say that, no, we do not want America involved in this situation, even, you know, despite this, you know, catastrophe of poison gas being used in this civil war. And they said that, well, what this expert said, that most people in Syria are between the extremes, and they neither support the Assad regime or support the opposition. And so they are going to be the ones who suffer. And I think this is just going to, you know, end up a domino kind of thing. We're going to get, you know, Lebanon involved, Iraq involved, Iran involved. And before you know it, you know, yeah, I think I agree with you. This could be like another World War One situation where we end up with a war in the Middle East.
For no damn good reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because some crazy guy started out. In the case of World War One, it was a crazy guy whose name I've long forgotten who shot Archduke Ferdinand, and then the treaty started tripping, and all those tripwires went and boom, all the right on down the road. And this could be the same thing. And particularly if Russia gets involved, I do not want to see us in another world war. Although I frankly wouldn't be surprised. Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to reiterate the point, you know, that we are not the world's policemen, that, you know, a unilateral attack against Syria, I think, would be a horrible mistake for us to make. I mean, I think that it would just give, I would think it would open the floodgates for retaliation. I think we're going to be blamed no matter what we do anyway. Yep. And frankly, I just don't understand what a military response would accomplish. I can't get my mind around how us going in there and just kind of, when there's this big war breaking out, it's all over the country, you know, you hear reports from all over Syria and all sorts of different cities. It's like, what is one targeted response going to prove? What is it going to do? I can't think of anything it's going to do besides lead to more engagement. And that's why I think that us getting involved is an absolutely horrible idea, especially if we do it unilaterally.
Yeah, I agree. And it's interesting. We're sort of taking a poll here. I'm taking calls pretty much on the order that they're coming in. And we're not filtering them by, you know, who's in favor of or who's against, you know, any involvement in Syria. And I'm starting to hear a consensus here. Catherine, thank you for the call. Catherine in New York City. Hey, Catherine, what's up?
Hi, Tom. We have war criminals in this country who killed more people than Assad. They were given a pass. Let bygones be bygones.
Right, you're talking about the Bush administration.
My other point quickly is Assad will have every military target stacked with innocent people, don't you think?
I do think. I absolutely think that, and either that or they'll be empty and he'll have someplace else to go. And, you know, he's got a plan B and a plan C and a plan D. He's, you know, he's playing chess on this thing. This guy's a survivor. He's been around for a long, long time. and he's a nasty, nasty man. And he's not going to just roll over because we go in and kick him in the shins. And that's pretty much all we can do. And we can't even take out his, he's got 1,000 tons of this deadly gas. We can't even take that out, because if we did, we'd be blowing, you know, you'd be releasing it in the country and it would kill hundreds of thousands of people. And so it's like there is no good way to do this, as far as I can tell. Catherine, thank you for the call. It's 27 minutes past the hour. We'll continue with your thoughts and mine on this issue of what should be done. What should our elected representatives be telling the president? Right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It was the good thing. It was the noble thing for President Obama to say, let's put this to Congress. Now, what should Congress say? The bad and the very, very aspectabundly ugly. The good. Congressman John Lewis, the Georgia congressman, joined in on last Thursday's Jobs with Justice March in Atlanta and gave a rousing speech supporting the marchers' call for a $15 living wage for all fast food workers. Check it out.
We need more than the minimum wage. We need a livable wage. And that's what this is all about. Some people are getting richer and richer and doing better and doing better, and others are getting poorer and poorer. That's not right.
Powerful words indeed. American workers are going through some tough times right now, but as long as they have supporters like Congressman Lewis, the labor movement, as well as the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King, will live on. The bad. Rush Limbaugh. On Friday's broadcast of his radio show, the conservative shock jock blasted the fast food strikes that have given the labor movement a jump start this Labor Day. Check this out.
This is not a legitimate protest on behalf of workers at Mickey D's who feel like they're underpaid. This is an organized rent-a-mob type of thing.
Right. This is just classic right-wing anti-worker propaganda. Sure, fast food workers got some help from unions like the SEIU. But the fact of the matter is that the real force behind last Thursday's strike was the desire of thousands of everyday workers to have a living wage. Without that desire, union help wouldn't have meant a thing. Rush, as usual, is just full of hot air. And the very, very ugly, distressed jeans. Yes, distressed jeans. According to a new joint report from the group Want on War and Students and Scholars Against Corporate Misbehavior, pre-torn jeans aren't just bad fashion, they're deadly fashion. Distressed jeans get their weathered look from a process called sandblasting, which involves firing abrasive sand onto denim under high pressure in a machine booth or via an air gun attached to a hose. The near-constant exposure to sandblasting puts millions of low-wage workers at denim factories across the world at risk of developing silicosis, a lung disease caused by breathing those sand particles. All this, of course, so wealthy consumers can pretend they worked so hard that they wore their jeans out. The irony here is outrageous and very, very ugly. It's really, that's pretty incredible. Okay, David in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, David, thank you for listening to Minneapolis's Progressive Voice, AM950. What's up?
Okay, my comments. I think you're wrong, and here's why. Your argument that no Americans were killed is none of our business would justify not intervening in the Holocaust where 12 million people were killed.
Not true.
So I just don't – but not true?
Not true.
Well, why not?
If you're going to do an apples-to-apples comparison, then you would have to imagine that in 1939, when the Holocaust was really getting under steam
– yeah.
That there was a United Nations. There wasn't, okay? But let's just imagine that there was. You also have to imagine that in 1939, when people were sneaking out of Germany, video and photographs and firsthand reports of the mass murder of Jews, as they were, that like today, there would be Twitter and Facebook and and the ability to transmit those very quickly so the whole world would know what was going on in 1939. So if the whole world knew what was going on in 1939, and if there was an international body called the United Nations, I don't believe that we would have had to wait till December of 1941 to involve ourselves in World War II. I think that the United Nations would have gotten together. They would have said what Adolf Hitler is doing is not just wrong, but so wrong and in violation of so many laws. In fact, I think when he first invaded Poland in the summer of 1939, that would have been the trigger point. At that point, the United Nations would have met. They would have said, this is illegal. Poland would have been the country that brought that action to the United Nations. And the United Nations would have stopped Hitler well before the Holocaust had killed even a third of its victims, in my opinion.
Well, okay. Again, I think your argument, you know,
you can disagree with my argument.
I'll give you another reason.
But see, my point is, this is not the Holocaust, and B, were it something as egregious as the Holocaust, and were the evidence as irrefutable as the Holocaust? I mean, John Kerry is not asserting that he has proof that Bashar al-Assad had actually ordered the gassing of anybody. All he has proof of is that somebody inside that military chain of command said, oh, you did that? Okay, yeah, we knew that was going to happen. Good, it's all done.
They're saying to go after and bomb Bashar either. They're saying take out the rocket launchers from which those gas attacks came. Doesn't matter who ordered them. Take out the source of the gas. And just
but they're not going to do that.
With one bombing attack and then left.
We're not going to have any success doing that.
What?
We are not going to be able to successfully do that. You can't take out the gas, first of all, because if you...
As a matter of fact, I think you're right. I think that Obama actually made a couple of terrible blunders along the way. I mean, the fact that he said months and months ago that the United States is drawing a line...
That was a big mistake.
Line, we're going to take action.
That was a mistake.
That was a mistake. But having made that mistake, to back out now compounds the mistake. I mean, it's going to make the United States look like a paper tiger. Then going to Congress, so then I think he should have gone in unilaterally, made one airstrike, and then left.
Politically, I agree with you.
He goes to Congress and says, oh, I want your permission to do this. And what's probably going to happen is that the Senate will approve it and the House of Representatives will disapprove it on purely political ground, Republican Democratic grounds, and he's going to look even worse.
Perhaps. It may well be. I mentioned earlier in the program, over the weekend, I had a brief conversation with a friend who's a Democratic strategist here in town, and he said, you know, Obama should have just gone in and, you know, taken out a couple of airfields, blown up some airplanes, taken out some rocket launchers, blown up a command and control center, you know, dusted off his hands and said that, you know, that's enough of that. Not done enough to really, you know, upset the Russians, but done enough that he could shut up his critics here in the United States. And initially, he never should have said, this is our red line. He should have said words to the effect of, you know, if the chemical biological weapons are used, then we will go to the United Nations and we will ask the United Nations to act, or we will strongly encourage them. This should be the world's red line. But to say it's ours, no, he shouldn't have done that. That I agree. That was a blunder, a foreign policy blunder and a political blunder. But that's all water under the bridge. The fact of the matter is now that... Well, this decision has to be made.
I think it's already been so badly bungled that there's no turning back. It's just it's a mess. And I think that.
But see, it's going, in my opinion, David, and this is why, again, also, I don't think that there's any Holocaust analogy here whatsoever. Had the world tried to stop Hitler when he had just gone into Poland, we could have stopped him. But the point is that right now, what the president is proposing doing is not stopping Hitler, is not stopping Assad, is not regime change. In fact, he's explicitly saying he's not going to do that. And frankly, our allies in the region, I don't think, would let him. And our non-allies in the region, I don't think, would let him. And so, you know, he finds himself in a very, very, very bad position. I would not want to be Barack Obama or John Kerry today.
I agree with that. I think that... If he had gone in, as you say, with just a few airstrikes here, a few airstrikes there, as soon as that line was crossed, he could have said, okay, that's our response to you guys crossing the line,
right,
and tried to make an argument out of that.
Right, but then you've got the problem that Assad would have just done it again, if it's actually Assad doing it. Or if it's people within Assad's regime who, you know, because there's a lot of people, a lot of generals and a lot of military people in Assad's regime who hate Assad. A lot of them left. They've become the rebels. Others of them stayed. And they might be the ones who did this in the hopes that we would come in and take out Assad. And if we did pinpoint, you know, basically slapping his hand kind of stuff, they would just do it again to get us to eventually they're going to try and get us to take out Assad. Or eventually Assad is going to thumb his nose at us to the point where we can't ignore it. Or eventually he's going to retaliate by doing something like lobbing a missile at our, as Alan Grayson suggested on this program in the first hour, you know, the embassy in Beirut is only 200 miles from Damascus. So, you know, Assad can, he's got missiles where he could easily take out the U.S. embassy.
He could. But I don't think for a second he would even do that, because at that point he has killed Americans. That's a clear act of war, and he would be inviting a whole-scale invasion of Syria.
Right.
I don't think he would risk that.
I doubt it, but...
Right, well, I doubt it very much.
What if, again, what if this isn't... What if he isn't completely in control of his own country? What if this is, you know, people within his own military doing this? Or what if that was done, but it was done by Hezbollah, by guys in Hezbollah who want to see us in conflict with that region? Or even more probable, what if it was done by guys in Al-Qaeda who want to see the Assad regime fall? Because the Sunnis want to take that country over, and the Al-Qaeda people are, you know, among the leadership of much of the Sunni group in that area.
Could I get a word in here?
Yeah.
My word is this. We could take a position of what amounts to instrumental conditioning. A gas attack was launched by someone.
If actually, about 30 of them have been.
Immediately by taking out the launchers and then going away. And
yeah.
You say, well, then they could do it again. Fine. Then we take out the launchers again. And every time they launch a gas attack, we respond immediately by taking out the launchers. And we aren't doing regime change. We aren't attacking a person. It doesn't matter who launched them.
David, it sounds very nice and it sounds very precise, but that's not how war happens. Respectfully.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And dropping bombs on countries that have not attacked you is an act of war. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Hey, how about that democracy thing here in the United States? Yes, let's do that. That's called a vote, and that's what the president's calling for, and I salute him for that. Even though I disagree with his position on Syria, I salute him for turning it over to the people's people, to the people's House of Representatives, the people's Senate. Laura in Chicago. Hey, Laura.
Yeah, hi. Tom, I just want to make it really clear what this is all about. It is not about humanitarian. If we really cared about the Syrians, we would stop arming the rebels. Saudi Arabia has given them the chemical weapons. Britain has
Britain
given weapons. Qatar, the U.S., Israel. We would stop arming the... Actually, they're not so much rebels as mercenaries. Foreign mercenaries that have gone in to fight these wars for these... Western alliance.
Yeah.
Now, the real issue here is this pipeline.
Yeah, two and a half hours ago, I started out talking about the geography of the region. And if you look at the cheapest oil in the world right now, therefore the most profitable for the oil companies, is coming out of the oil fields in Western Iraq, which have just been opened up, and they're just starting to develop these things. And they need to get that oil out of Western Iraq. And what is right next door to Western Iraq? Eastern Syria. And Western Syria, what is on Western Syria? The Mediterranean Ocean. You want to get that oil out of Iraq and into Europe, just a lickety-split as fast as you can, you run a pipeline across Syria. That, in my opinion, is what this is all about.
And there's actual natural gas pipelines. It's actually
there is one right now.
Called Pipelineistan. And Qatar, what happened was 2 years ago, Iran, Iraq, and Syria went into an agreement to build the pipeline to the Mediterranean for natural gas.
Yeah.
And it was going to go to through Tartus in Syria. It was called the Shiite Islamic Pipeline. And so the Russians have leased out Tartus. So the Russians are involved with that pipeline.
Sure.
And Iraq, and they're going to be starting to build this pipeline. Qatar wants their own pipeline, and they don't want the competition.
Right.
The Iranian, Iraqi.
And Qatar is down on the Persian Gulf. They want the oil going south, not west.
They want a pipeline through Saudi Arabia into Jordan, through Syria to Turkey. Turkey is mad because they're being cut out of this Islamic pipeline. That's why Turkey's involved, because they're being cut out. So it is absolutely about pipelines and consolidation. And guess what? They found more natural gas in Homs, Syria.
Which is, a country in the north central part of the northwestern central part of Syria. Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And that is why now they want to capture that area so that they can consolidate their power over that natural gas. So this is about all of our buddies. Qatar, right, is our buddy. They have bases.
Yeah.
We have several bases in Qatar. And, cheap natural gas for France. Turkey gets to be in on the pipeline.
Yep.
Israel gets cheap gas.
Right, and Russia gets screwed, which might have something to do with why Russia's a little PO'd about this.
Bingo.
Yeah,
that's
bingo.
Exactly right.
Now, Laura, thank you for the call. You laid it out very clearly. Sarah in Young. Whoop! I must have pushed the button twice. I'm sorry, Sarah. I bounced you right off. Lee in Missoula, Montana. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Hello. Let me get you off. Yes. Let me try to do this clearly. My thing, basically, is I feel the first thing the president we need to do, if we're going to do anything about Iraq, is find out who actually used the gas,
the poison gas. Right. And if Assad used that poison gas, take him to The Hague.
That's
in absentia.
Right. Once he's got an indictment from The Hague on him, then we can be policemen. Right now, we're just bullies.
Yeah. I think that's well said. Lee, thank you for the call. Sarah, thank you for calling back in Young America, Minnesota. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Real quick, I just want to clarify and make sure I'm understanding. If we were to just go into Syria and just drop a few missiles as you were talking about earlier on the show, wouldn't that be similar to what we did in Iraq and Afghanistan without having Congress actually vote on whether or not we should do that? So in my mind, I'm thinking Obama's doing the right thing by having Congress vote on it rather than just go in and start bombing.
I absolutely agree. I was telling you was that a Democratic consultant told me that he thought that the best thing politically would have been for Obama to do that. I think the best, but I disagree with him. I disagree with his thinking on that. I mean, I agree with him politically. The best thing politically for Obama to have done would be the minute that it looked like, this had happened, to do some pinprick airstrikes and say, okay, that's that. Now let's debate the budget. But that's not what Obama decided to do. Instead, he decided to do what the Constitution calls for, which is turn the ability to make war, turn that power over to Congress. Thank God he did. I mean, it's the first president in a long time that's done that. I absolutely support Obama's decision to turn this over to Congress. I disagree with Obama's proposal that we should be attacking Syria when we have not been attacked. But I honor and support his, and I'm so pleased that he's our president doing it this way. I mean, this is not what George Bush would have done. It's not, I'm skeptical that it's what Bill Clinton would have done. But, I think he put his constitutional scholar hat on and he's doing the right thing in asking for Congress. Now, he's asking Congress to do the wrong thing, in my opinion. But, hey, that's just my opinion. And that's really up to Congress. We are a constitutionally limited representative democracy, Democratic Republic.
Yep. All right.
Am I making sense?
Thank you, Tom.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
And thank you for letting me clarify. I appreciate it. So, anyway, we'll be continuing with this, I'm sure, as we continue through the week. And coming up tomorrow, all the latest on the developments in the fragile situation in Syria, plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport, particularly in this day and age. You need to get out there and get active. Tag Yuri. Get out there and occupy something. See you tomorrow.
been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.